Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Genocide did not begin, nor did it end, with the Holocaust, in which 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazi regime of Adolf Hitler. But that was not the end of genocide, as the systematic murders in Cambodia, Bosnia, and Rwanda have shown us. At the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center here in St. Louis, a new high-tech exhibit will open tomorrow, detailing the history of the Holocaust and the history that followed it. This is an interactive exhibit in which special attention is being given to the social injustice, hate, ethnic conflict, and discrimination still very much present in this world, and to provide insight into how to curb them. The exhibit is titled Change Begins With Me and was created in partnership with the Anti-Defamation League, Hate Breakers, and Webster University. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me to talk about the exhibit and the history it reflects, Gene Cavender is the director of the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. Dr. Warren Rosenblum is associate professor of history and director of European studies at Webster University. Dr. Michael Holzheiser is professor of psychology and chair of the Department of Behavioral and Social Sciences at Webster University. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Gene, let me begin with you. This exhibit, which opens tomorrow, how is it going to enhance what already exists there?
Well, first of all, let me say that the museum was established in memory of Gloria M. Goldstein about 18 years ago, and we are a department of the Jewish Federation of St. Louis. And this exhibition has actually, this is the first new exhibition that we've done since 10 years ago. We did an exhibition called Renewal of Life, and it really focused on how people who immigrated here to the St. Louis area, actually how their families flourished, how they escaped. They didn't escape the Holocaust. They were victims of the Holocaust. So the exhibition basically ended at that point. And for years, we have been really mulling over the idea of really bringing into focus a more contemporary discussion of what's happening in today's world. And what this exhibition, Change Begins With Me, allows us to do is to use contemporary examples of bias, discrimination, and genocide in today's world. And it's been about 3 years in the making, and we worked with a number of people. Obviously, you mentioned all of our partners that have worked with us, and I want to talk about David Schenberg of Panamedia and Karen Handelman of 501 Creative, who really helped us develop the visitor experience. The exhibition is really focused on trying to bring, again, contemporary issues and to contemporize the discussion about genocide and hate in our world. And we realized that when we ended the exhibition that many people just figured, well, that's over. That didn't happen. This new exhibition, and with the beauty of touchscreen technology, we're able to bring new stories to light. We certainly talk about the post-Holocaust genocides, the big ones that you mentioned earlier on Bosnia, Cambodia, and Rwanda. And we have the ability to bring up those narratives and then the exhibition is set up in such a way that people can touch the screen, that narrative comes up, we have the ability to show photographs, we have the ability to get video testimony from individuals who actually endured those particular genocides, and again, bring up more contemporary issues and talking about that.
What are some of those contemporary issues specifically?
Well, one in particular, And actually, Warren can probably speak a little better to that. There's anti-Semitism and hatred in Hungary that's going on right now. The Roma and Sinti populations and the Jewish populations are actually being targeted today. Gypsy Hungarians are being evicted from their homes, and no one is really talking about this issue. And at the last writing, which was actually a few days ago, there was a call for Jews who are in Parliament at this point or working in the government to be signed on to a registry to be tracked. So these kinds of things are happening. And, you know, one of the questions we pose and what we want to do in terms of bringing it right back to, again, the Holocaust history is to say, what similarities do you see happening in this particular incident that happened in the 30s during the Holocaust? And Warren, do you have anything to add to that?
Warren, I would just suggest before you start, I've not been reading about this situation in Hungary. I mean, has it been well publicized? Is this something that most people, do you think, or a lot of people know about? Mm.
Well, the right-wing resurgence in Hungary more generally has been a very troubling factor. And Hungary's a relatively small country. They consider themselves to be Central Europe. Americans are in the habit of calling that Eastern Europe. And, of course, they were behind the Iron Curtain. And since 1956, really, Hungary hasn't been terribly much in the United States media and in our awareness. So I guess it's not too surprising that as their experiment with democracy since the fall of the Iron Curtain has been subsequently troubled, and as they've gone through a number of crises that we haven't heard about it. And so I don't know that much about the situation right now in Hungary, but I can say that overall there have been restrictions on civil liberties. There's been a real burst of xenophobia. There's been the rise of a very hard, radical right-wing group. And this animosity towards gypsies in particular, what many people prefer to call Sinti and Roma. Gypsies has become something of a derogatory term for some populations. That the animosity towards the gypsies and the mistreatment is a long story, and it's simply getting worse, and it's getting more frightening today. And it certainly deserves to be in people's consciousness. And so I really appreciate the fact that the museum is allowing that kind of gateway into learning about that issue, among others.
Jean, is this going to be a permanent exhibit?
It is. Yes. And the beauty of it is the fact that we can change the stories. We can update things. And really, again, depending on which stories we choose to show on the board, because we can't show every piece of discrimination and hate that's happening in the world today. We're specifically citing definite incidents that we think will be helpful in terms of kind of connecting the dots with what the history and lessons of the Holocaust with what's happening in today's world.
Is the focus going to be primarily on Jewish communities, both domestically and internationally?
No. No. In fact, some of the things that we're talking about that are on the international circuit do have to do with anti-Semitism. We do highlight some issues. Say, for example, the Matthew Shepard story is something that we've talked about.
The gay murder victim.
Exactly. And we talk about James Byrd of Jasper, Texas.
Dragged by a pickup truck.
Exactly. Well, you're certainly aware of all those things.
They're pretty famous stories.
And we even highlight in St. Louis our own knockout game. Certainly something. And we think that those kinds of issues, and we're not comparing those kinds of things to genocide, but we're saying these are hate issues that are happening in our own community.
Well, all of these major problems have to start with that single step, don't they? So that is significant.
Well, that's an excellent point. And I would turn to my colleague, Mike, to start talking about one part of the exhibition, which really focuses on the progression of hate. And Mike was very instrumental in helping us define some of the human behavior that can eventually lead to genocide. And Mike,
What we did with the progression of hate component is talked about how there's various steps that lead eventually into something such as genocide. So we have a spiral, if you will, that spirals downward from stereotyping to prejudice to discrimination, violence, and eventually genocide. The idea was to connect us to individuals visiting the museum at a very base level. So while it may be difficult to understand what's happening in Hungary, all of us have experienced stereotyping. All of us have probably engaged in stereotyping, have engaged in prejudice and possibly discrimination. So for individuals coming in, it's a way for them to connect to something that they experience in everyday life.
One of the things that I saw in getting ready for this program was a phrase attributed to you, spirals of hate. You just alluded to that a moment ago. What exactly is that?
Well, the spiral starts with it's tough for people to envision that a country like the United States could end up engaging in genocide. But it's much easier for people to look at the common everyday events that occur in our lives. And so bullying, for example, we have a number of middle school and high school students who will come to the museum. And so they've experienced bullying. They know what it is. And they can see the connection. Okay, when you treat people as different from you, when you start doing an us and them dichotomy, that sort of thing can eventually lead into something as horrific as genocide. So that spiral is sort of starting off at common things that we do and eventually getting tighter and tighter to something as explosive, as horrific as genocide.
Can you address the group psychology that allows this sort of thing to happen? And Nazi Germany is probably the best example that people would be familiar with. What happens to a group of people that allows them to condone this sort of activity?
Well, I mean, one element that typically, when we look across various genocides that we see, is crisis. So the role of crisis is an important component. So something has happened to mobilize individuals. Also, we do look at the role of dehumanization. When you look at the spiral, one common theme that runs through that is our willingness to dehumanize. So when you stereotype people, you're treating them as you're taking away their individuality. You're de-individuating them and dehumanizing them. And when you treat people in the us and them categories, you do the same sort of thing. Discrimination, violence, you can't do those sort of things with an individual who you treat as your brother, your sister, if you will. You're dehumanizing. And so that thread works its way through the spiral, if you will, is working downwards into genocide.
In the time we have before the break, and I want to get back to Warren with regard to the Holocaust and some of the things that were happening here. Do you see anything in our current society in this country today that would indicate we're at some level of this spiral?
Well, certainly the presidential election, we had a lot of us and them. One thing that is very troubling, though, is that one of my areas of interest and that I do some research on are hate groups. And so we saw that with hate groups, there's been an explosion of hate since 2000. The Southern Poverty Law Center has tracked the number of hate groups, and it went from about 600 or so in 2000. 2011, we're at about 1,018, about a 69% increase in hate groups. Militia groups have increased 755% since when President Obama was first elected in 2008. So we went from 149 to over 1,200 militia groups. That's a big change. And so are we at a tipping point of sorts? Well, you have a while to go to get to the point of genocide, but certainly we're becoming a very divided country, and that's not a good thing.
And there is a certain element of xenophobia, too, that Warren mentioned a moment ago with regard to undocumented folks coming into this country.
And whenever you have an economic crisis, people start to look for answers and they start to lay blame. And so the them, if you will, us being Americans, whatever, however we define that, and them being immigrants. And so we look at them as being the cause of all of our problems.
I have to take a break. Let's do that now. We are talking about a new exhibit that's going to open tomorrow at the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center here in the St. Louis area. Director Gene Cavender of that institution is with us, as is Warren Rosenblum, Associate Professor of History and Director of European Studies at Webster University. Michael Holsizer is Professor of Psychology and Chair for the Department of Behavioral and Social Studies at Webster University. The exhibit focuses on the Holocaust, as I mentioned, and it's basically designed to teach people. I think the Jewish population and the German population said long after World War II, nie wieder, never again. And that's precisely what this particular exhibit is aimed at fostering. Back in just a moment with our guests. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation dealing primarily with the opening of a new exhibit at the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. That's going to be opening tomorrow. We'll have more on that a little bit later. But we're also talking about the kinds of things, the ingredients that make up hate crimes and discrimination and the kinds of things that we've been reading about for the last several years. Genocide did not end with the Holocaust, as I mentioned earlier, and this exhibit is designed to try to keep that sort of thing from happening again on the very basic level, and we all are experiencing that one way or another from time to time, and also on the global and grander scope. Back to Warren now, Warren Rosenblum. You know, you've listened to Michael and you've listened to Gene. Many people may not understand exactly why it was that Hitler chose the Jews for his final solution, if you will. Why did he?
Well, boy, there's the $10,000 question in some ways. The way historians think about this now is in two major contexts. One is the context of anti-Semitism, which is certainly not an invention of Hitler. Sure. And anti-Semitism has roots that go back to the Middle Ages and even before. It became especially powerful in its modern form in Europe, ironically, after Jews were emancipated. For the first time, Jews were given the political and civil and legal freedoms of equality, and not just in Germany, but almost everywhere in Europe at the end of the 19th century. And in that context, there was a really strong backlash by people who felt that Jews were alien and that Jews had an obligation, now that they were emancipated, to become just like us in every aspect. And that is to say, they should become farmers, they should become craft workers, they should become exactly like the rest of the population in terms of their demographics, in terms of their wealth, in terms of their education. And ideally, they should really become Christians, because what's the point of their separateness now that they've been emancipated? And so there was a certain underlying sense of a broken contract when Jews continued to be, on some level, on many levels, culturally, politically, economically different. And there was a kind of brooding sense that that emancipation was a failure on the part of elements within the Christian population. Hitler drew from that what we sometimes call passive anti-Semitism, that widespread sense of emancipation as a failure. It became radicalized largely as a result of World War I, when not just Germany but so many countries in Central Europe were struggling to find their identity and to recover from this, from the humiliation of the lost war, from the destruction of what had been a very stabilizing empire in the center of Europe, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And nationalism became radicalized. We often call this hyper-nationalism. And more national identity was therefore built on looking for enemies, looking for the other that one could define oneself against. And anti-Semitism in this era could have taken violent forms just about anywhere, and it did take a very violent form in the Ukraine right after World War I, where there were horrible pogroms. There was anti-Semitic violence in Romania. There was anti-Semitic violence in various parts of Eastern and Central Europe. There was an upsurge of anti-Semitism in France. But of course, it's in Germany where this anti-Semitism was embodied in a very powerful political movement, a gigantic political movement that drew on a whole host of resentments and discontents and then became a state ideology. And so it's really only in Germany where it took on such an extraordinarily dangerous dynamic, largely because it was wedded to a very successful mass movement. And then, of course, it reached its ultimate flowering during the next war, which was World War II. And I think most historians would agree that the notion that the Holocaust was planned from the moment Hitler came to power is just not true. That's really a myth. There were anti-Semitic policies planned from the very beginning. There was an effort to push back what they saw as the excessive Jewish influence in society. But it's really in the Second World War, it's really in the context of the horrific violence of World War II, that the latent anti-Semitism was brought to the front, and the whole power of the German state, in collaboration, sadly, with a lot of the conquered peoples, was then brought to bear on the destruction of the Jewish people.
Michael, in a certainly a perverse way, this was a pretty good strategy, was it not, to take a minority and make it the enemy, and therefore the majority would coalesce against this minority?
Yeah, that's correct. The one thing we talk about in the exhibit in this spiral, if you will, about violence is the role of things like scapegoating. And so many individuals coming to the exhibit can kind of identify with the idea of blaming a group for the ills of society. Certainly in Nazi-occupied Germany, we saw that. And, of course, we see that today, as we mentioned, with immigrant populations and what have you, saying that they're the blame for what's gone wrong. Also, whenever you have a zero-sum game, there's a theory we have called realistic conflict theory, which points out that whenever two groups are competing for similar resources, there's going to be some inherent tension. The groups will start to break into us versus them dynamics, and then you'll start seeing the discrimination, the violence, and so on and so forth.
Right. Gene, anything to add to that?
This is why this exhibition is so good, because of these two gentlemen. They've done a great job. Let me just say, with respect to the exhibition itself, our point is it was kind of segmented into three parts. It's the no section, which we want KNOW, which we want people to really know about the events that are happening today. We have the learn section, which is where people can learn more. They can touch the screen, and we will connect them with various websites where they can learn more about what's happening. And then we also have what's called a do section. And that's where we give people ideas about how to take action. And you can take action. And one of the big themes that we have when we tour people through the Holocaust Museum and really kind of punctuate it with this particular exhibition is we want people to take action when they see social injustices occur. And that can happen on the playground, or it can happen, you can do something to take a stand against something that's happening on the other side of the world. And the beauty of all of these things is people can email these narratives to the classroom and continue the discussion. So they can email the narratives, the questions are included, and again, they can finish their tour of the Holocaust, come to this exhibition, and we want them to do that, to indeed continue the discussion. It's so important.
We can put a question to our listeners as to how responsive would you be or have you been to the kinds of things that Gene Cavender just talked about. When you see discrimination, bullying, or any of these things that we've discussed, how responsive have you been? 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk at stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL On Air, or also reach us through Facebook. We have a call that I think relates directly to what you were just talking about, Gene. So let's take bring in Grace, calling from Kirkwood. Grace, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. My name is Grace Marting, and I work with a national organization called 1 Million Bones. And our whole goal is we would like to raise awareness about genocide and humanitarian crises occurring right now in nations like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, Somalia, and Burma. And our whole goal is to lay down 1 million handmade clay bones on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in June of next year. This will be a visible petition in a symbolic mass grave of all the lives lost in these conflicts. So we want students, churches, and other groups to get involved and make bones for this installation. And in doing so, they learn about these contemporary issues of genocide.
Grace, that is great. And I'm actually familiar with your organization. One of my colleagues, one of my docents, excuse me, Kathy Lass, is very involved in that. And you know, it's a wonderful program, and we would be happy, if you want to get in touch with me after this, to focus on it and bring it up as one of the points of information where people can go, because along with the exhibition, the large touchscreen monitor that we have a number of smaller screens that people can actually go to and do additional research on, and we'd love to have your organization as one of our launching sites.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Great. That would be a perfect opportunity.
All right.
We have a link, by the way, to the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center website on our website, STL Public Radio On Air. So I'm sure that you can reach Gene that way if you'd care to go to that site. Okay?
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And while I have this note in front of me, let me point out that the Change Begins With Me exhibit that we've been talking about opens tomorrow morning at 9:45. It will be open Monday through Thursdays from 9:30 to 4:30 p.m., 9:30 to 4 p.m. on Fridays. And again, we have a link to the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center at stlpublicradio.org. All right, let me get back here and see if we had somebody. I thought we had somebody else. Yes, let's bring in Harvey, calling from Chesterfield. Harvey, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. And I want to thank your guests for all the work they're doing. It's very important work. I'm just wondering, in our country right now, we have a real strong tendency to not want to get involved with being the police of the world. And And I'm wondering what's in this display that would help people understand that there are times when it's appropriate for us to get involved. I think of, you know, getting involved in World War II a little bit earlier than we did would have saved a lot of lives.
Go ahead, Warren.
Yeah, thank you. That's such an important question. And, you know, the very word genocide is a contemporary creation. The word was invented at the very end of World War II by not by an historian, not by somebody looking backwards, but by an activist, somebody who was concerned about the future. A man named Raphael Lemkin coined the word genocide exactly to address what you're alluding to, which is the need to have a concept to describe acts which are so morally egregious that they should be a trigger for world engagement and world involvement. And you're absolutely right that we constantly ask ourselves in the United States, you know, can we police the world? When is it absolutely necessary for us to become involved? And that's what Lemkin wanted to create with the term genocide. Now, that, of course, begs the question of, well, when do you decide that genocide is really about to happen or is already happening? And clearly that's complicated, and we want this exhibit to be complicated. We don't want to give simple answers. We want to foster discussion. But simply having the concept genocide and being aware of it and understanding the definition that it represents, the possibility of the destruction of a culture, of a nation, of a people, that this would be the trigger which would really require, no matter what else is going on in America, no matter how we're preoccupied, that this represents a moment when we have a moral responsibility to be engaged.
No, I appreciate that in terms of genocide. Is there a differentiation between that and simply an oppressive regime that are killing their own ethnicity?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the definition of genocide doesn't preclude interventions for other reasons. Now, obviously, the United States has an obligation to consider its own national interest, and in every matter of intervention, we're balancing various concerns. So, you know, there's the case of World War II and whether and when the United States should have become involved earlier, you know, is something historians love to debate. A lot of people feel that the appeasement in 1938 was a disgrace and that already at that stage the United States should have been involved in stopping Hitler. I would quickly point out that even then it was a complicated question. I mean, getting involved in Hitler's attack on Czechoslovakia in 1938 would have potentially brought the Russians into Eastern Europe. And, of course, Stalin was a mass murderer himself. And so that's, to me, paradigmatic of the fact that these issues are never simple. And yet at least we have the concept of genocide as a clear sign of when intervention has to happen.
Michael.
Thank you very much.
But also to add that the exhibit also allows or points out that individuals themselves can also do quite a bit. I mean, today with social media the way it is and our previous caller, you yourself can do a great deal by getting people involved, getting people organized. And today technology helps us quite a bit with reaching out to people. So it's not just looking at the United States getting involved, but we do see change happening with individuals. And I think that's part
of
it.
Right, and that is the focus of the exhibition. We want people to kind of reflect inward and say, and again, it comes to your question, do you think people are, what someone else asked me, do you think one person can make a difference? Well, yes, we have seen that happen. We've featured Judy Shepard, Matthew Shepard's mother, who was very instrumental in developing what has become hate crimes legislation. Paul Rusesabagina of Hotel Rwanda saved 1,200 individuals during the Rwandan genocide. I'm going to point to Susan Balk, who is one of our partners in all of this, who started Hate Breakers, which is a great organization that is designed to really confront bullying. So individuals can actually make a difference.
You want a whole bunch of Howard Buells out there. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore, right? Okay. We've got some emails and some calls. We have a listener in Soulard who prefers not to have the name used for obvious reasons. This person writes, being Iranian-American, I have fears of receiving some of the hatred that's being directed toward the Middle East, and especially with the situation in Iran, pursuing nuclear capabilities escalating in recent months. At times, I'm hesitant to tell people of my heritage, something that I used to be very proud of. And this goes back to where we were at the beginning of this program. Right. There are a lot of people like this out
right.
there.
And there are instances of that happening in our community.
So what advice do we have for this person?
Great question. I mean, I think that I think what that person would be helpful for that person to do is to get a set of allies, people who are out there speaking on her behalf or his behalf. I'm not sure. Those are important things that that we can, again, raise awareness about. And we can do it through this exhibition as well. Just making people aware.
And meeting people from other cultures and contexts. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that we become more provincial and that people aren't meeting folks from Iran. I mean, you think of the incredible diversity of Iranians. I mean, just at Webster University, we have someone from Iran who is a former officer in the Shah's Navy and is extremely secular. And we have somebody else who's there from Iran who has something more of a religious background. And I mean, people need to meet Iranians just like they need to meet people from other cultures and get free of those stereotypes that Mike talked about.
Right. The phrase that you hear quite often is they're all alike. You know, they're all the same. And that stereotype, you know, that us and them dynamic and the fact that we look at people as being very similar is very helpful in a cognitive way. We're able to process information very quickly. But unfortunately, it leads to these consequences where all individuals of a particular ethnicity or origin are looked upon the same way. And that's just completely inaccurate.
On a certain level, and I'm thinking primarily of the interfaith community here in St. Louis. St. Louis has a pretty good record in this regard on levels such as that. When it comes down to individuals, maybe not so good. We'll come back and continue our conversation. With me in studio is Michael Holsizer, professor of psychology and chair for the Department of Behavioral and Social Studies at Webster University. Warren Rosenblum, associate professor of history and director of European studies at Webster University. And Gene Cavender, director of the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. We're talking about a new exhibit that will be opening tomorrow at the Learning Center. And we'll have more on that in just a bit. We'll come back and take more of your calls, emails, and tweets. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation. We are talking about genocide very much in general and about discrimination and hate crimes and that sort of thing, all focusing primarily on an exhibit that opens tomorrow at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. I have a tweet here that I'd like to read to you. What do guests think of modern teens who get tattoos of their older relatives' concentration camp numbers? Disgraceful or respectful? Any thoughts?
I've heard about that. It's hard to say. I mean, it obviously is something that teens do feel strongly about. And tattooing, I'm not a big fan of it, but it is one of those things that if that's how they feel like they want to pay homage to their relatives who actually did survive the Holocaust, I guess we'll have to live with that. But I don't know. Gentlemen, what do you think?
I guess I would say that if it serves the purpose of starting a conversation,
that's a great point.
That would be very helpful for people not to forget, of course, and to discuss what that is. And so that could be helpful.
Warren, any thoughts on that?
Oh, I do worry sometimes about the Holocaust becoming a kind of cult of death. You know, I think the fascination with the Holocaust among the youth is good. When it stimulates thought, when it allows them to learn about history and to think critically about the dynamics of hatred. But I don't want to see it become a fetish. And I read that story, too, in the New York Times, and I found it upsetting. On the other hand, if it means something to the survivors and the grandparents of these kids, then obviously that's their choice, and And of course, I have two daughters, so any thought, any discussion of tattoos makes me nervous because they could be listening. You know.
Well, I hope they're listening. Gene, is this new setup that you have here, this new interactive exhibit, is this aimed primarily at young people?
It is geared for all visitors. We certainly have made the language pretty accessible. We want, and we've put up, different kinds of examples of things that we hope will relate to middle, high school, and adults. So it really crosses the range.
We have another tweet here, and I think this one is directed at Eugene. It says the museum director, that would be you, says the new exhibit will not focus only on Jews. Which issues, global or local, would you like to see explored?
Oh, well, yeah, as I was saying earlier, we've talked about Matthew Shepard, the incident for James Burden in Jasper, Texas, who was an African-American who was dragged through the streets of Jasper, Texas, and murdered by white supremacists. And we focus on our own local community, the knockout game. So it's not all anti-Semitic, and we'll have more stories as life goes on, because we know hate and discrimination continue to flourish.
Let me make a pitch for the international elements of this exhibit as well. A number of Webster students worked on fleshing out the discussion of the dangers of genocide around the world and what's happened since the Holocaust. So there's a section that they wrote on Rwanda and the genocide there, on Cambodia, on Bosnia. And as we said at the beginning of this program, you have places like Hungary, which just are not at all in the consciousness of the average American. And they need to know what's going on there. They need to know about the Congo today and the real serious threat of genocide that's unfolding there. And all of these are places that Americans have something to say and should have something to say.
Right.
With regard to our local community, you've mentioned some well-known instances that have taken place. What do you see locally that would consider?
Right now, we just have the knockout game on there. Yeah. We're looking at some other things. Right. One of the things, we actually work with Karen Oresti through the Anti-Defamation League, because often what happens, something is reported as a hate crime in the media, and there has not been enough information. So we work with her because she usually has a lot of the insider information about that particular crime, because she's often alerted to it, and we'll discern from her recommendation whether or not it's a hate crime. And several things have come up, and I will run things by her, and she said, not a hate crime, there are extenuating circumstances.
I thought you might mention that some of the communities in our area that have taken a very tough stance against undocumented aliens.
Oh.
And, I mean, that's going on in a number of communities.
That certainly is open for discussion, and we will certainly look into that. We just don't have anything up at this time on the board.
All right. Let's get back to the phones and bring in Karen, calling from the Central West End. Karen, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. President Clinton recalls his administration's response to the genocide in Rwanda as one of the greatest failures of his presidency. And I'm wondering, my judgment, there seems to be a lack of the same level of empathy or compassion for the genocides on the continent of Africa. And I would like to hear the panelists' response to that, too. I see a lot of young people taking charge in things with the Sudan and in the Congo, but it doesn't seem to be an issue for mainstream America. And I'll take your responses off the air. Thank you so much for this program.
Oh, you are so right about that. And I think the beginning of the problem is that we just don't hear enough about Africa in general. We need more coverage of Africa. We need to, by the way, not just hear the bad news about Africa. We need to hear more good news because it's there. And look at the newspapers. They're just everywhere in the country. They're limiting international coverage of all kinds. And even the New York Times, if I'm not mistaken, has two correspondents for the entire continent. I mean, maybe there's a third if you count Egypt, but there's not enough attention to begin with. And then you have something like the situation that's unfolding in the Congo today, and it seems very confusing to people. Well, it's confusing in part because the average American probably can't find the Congo on the map, and that's the starting place of this trouble. But secondarily, people are become indifferent as they are closed off from that kind of discussion.
Did you mention NPR? Because NPR has quite a coterie of people in Africa.
Yeah.
A lot of coverage from that part of the world. Yeah. Just thought I'd get that in, Warren. And
small
oversight.
NPR is an exception in every realm, isn't it?
An email from Tom here. Never again, in quotes, the never again vow did not prevent genocide in Bosnia. Thus, something more than museums and remembering is needed. Is that not obvious?
Well, we've done some work with the Bosnian community here in St. Louis, and as you know, it is the largest Bosnian population in the United States. And we put together an exhibition of that that particular genocide with some folks who were particularly interested in highlighting what happened in a community called Prijedor. And showcased it at the museum, and that exhibition still has legs. It's going around the country. And I think that's partly, you know, what the Jewish community has been able to do, and so many have been able to document and certainly establish these museums all over. You know, we're one of 20 in the United States. Not every community has one, but you want to remember, but you also want to you want to be able to take some action. Now, I know recently we were contacted by our colleagues in the Bosnian community about the possibility of having a panel discussion about the fact that, and they're upset about this, is that so many people who were perpetrators during that genocide are now high in government and not being prosecuted at all. So, yeah, lots of discussion needs to continue to happen. So there's lots of work still to be done.
And the museum and the Learning Center
exactly.
are just one part of
exactly.
that, obviously. It doesn't have all the
yeah,
answers.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Well, and also we're at Webster University. We have a very large Bosnian population at the university. I know Warren and I, when we will be looking for more students to contribute to the exhibit, you know, we hope that certainly we'll have some more different viewpoints from that coming forward from some of our students.
Yep. Back to the phones now. Let's bring in Art calling from South St. Louis. Art, nice to talk to you again, but make it short and sweet, if you would.
Okay, Don, you might remember I talked about inflation, particularly hyperinflation, to the Federal Reserve. I'm looking at Greece in particular right now with the social unrest and the condemnation of some of these rising hate groups, particularly of Albanian nationalism. But I think your guests sort of historically truncate the effect of Theodor Herzl back in 1861 with the Zionist movement and the espousing of this globalism. And I'm just bringing into play then the League of Nations as far as their penalization of the World War One. And then the open borders that were required and the multicultural effect and the changing of the cultural with respect to a very disciplined and nationalistic country. You know, there was a great deal of effort made to go ahead and trade off a lot of the Jewish populations to the British back during World War II.
Art, I would love to have you come sit in on my class at Webster so we could tangle with each other and wrestle with these issues, because there's a lot there and they're great comments.
Art always has an interesting perspective, and he's obviously has studied history and is certainly willing to talk about it, and he does often on this program. He did mention one thing that I think is worth mentioning, and perhaps it's part of the exhibit, and that is what is going on in Greece today.
Right.
Because there is a neo-Nazi faction that is apparently gaining some traction in Greece today.
That's absolutely right, and yeah. We do have that particular narrative up. In talking about the fact that, and again, it's hearkening back to the scary part of the 1930s, where 7% of the parliament are now part of a group called Golden Dawn. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, but it's a neo-Nazi group, yeah. and they're being legitimized and are working in parliament and trying to spread their hate in that regard.
And they seem to have come out of nowhere, which
right.
is a real shock for
right.
Europe watchers.
Many of the dynamics exactly the same
exactly.
as what we were talking about in the 30s and
exactly.
in Nazi Germany.
Lots of it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
One question that I wanted to ask with regard to your exhibit, and people may be wondering, should I bring my 5-year-old or my 10-year-old to it? Is this something that is suitable for young people?
We typically don't have people bring their children if they're not any older than about age 11. That's about a good time when we think that kids are actually ready to kind of maybe absorb and think about this information without being terribly overwhelmed by it.
Michael, do you want to weigh in on that with regard to young people digesting some of this stuff?
I think what would be helpful is for parents to attend the museum and then think about appropriate ways how to talk to their 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, because there's a lot of programs that are out there. I know there's some Montessori schools, some of the school systems that are working on anti-bullying and treating people as individuals. And those things, although they're not talking about genocide per se, they're really important for that beginning part of the stereotyping, the prejudice and what have you. So, you know, I would encourage families, you know, the parents to come out and view that and then take that message back and then give that in a way that's understandable for their children.
And teachers. I mean, the museum does so much with teachers. I mean, they bring in school groups constantly, but also they do teacher training. And
That's a great point.
Well, one of the reasons I brought that up is that an email that we have from Rana here says, my 12-year-old had the opportunity to preview The Change Begins With Me and was absolutely moved to action. She emailed some of the materials to herself and talked with her advisor at school about the concepts. Brittany is going to be leading a discussion at her school about it. Highly recommend the exhibit. That's what you like to hear, Jean Cavender,
isn't
it? I
like to hear that. Thank you, Rana, for that comment. And, again, we're back to, and I just want to piggyback on what Mike said, how a child responds to the exhibition or any part of the exhibition that we are involved with, it really demands a level of preparation. And we find that the students who really do get that level of preparation really do a great deal of you know, action steps or, you know, discussion about it. If we have a number of students who will come in and often have been given no preparation for what they're about to see, and those are students that are often overwhelmed by the whole exhibition. So I would just caution people to do that.
Before time gets away from us, I know that this is the Learning Center and the museum is not, this is not the only thing that's going on, that you have yet another exhibition that's opening up you want folks to know about.
If you don't mind. We have a new exhibition. It's a temporary exhibition that's going to open on Sunday, December 16th. It's entitled Standing for Justice, 1930 to 1950. It's documentation from our own St. Louis Jewish Community Archives, and it focuses on the documents and artifacts that illustrate the St. Louis Jewish community's response to discrimination in general and anti-Semitism in particular in our own community. And that exhibition is being co-sponsored by the Brodsky Community Library and the Jewish Community Relations Council and the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. And we hope that you will come out and take a look. That exhibition starts at 1 o'clock on December 16th, and it will be up for quite a while.
I'll ask the two gentlemen here what changes you saw in students. Michael, you alluded to this before, those students who were involved in this project. What changes did you see in them as a result of the work they did in it?
Well, I think what was meaningful for them was the fact that they were creating something that other, you know, other potential students, other individuals would use and potentially could make change. So for them, it was instead of being in class and learning about, you know, facts and figures and what have you, they're actually doing something that potentially could cause significant change throughout our region and beyond. And so that was pretty moving, I think, for them.
Maren, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with that, and I would also say just to have to take a stand, to filter all of their reading and all of the discussion down to a very concise text, in the end possibly not concise enough, but thanks to Gene's brilliant editors, it's been made into a very readable text. But I think my students found that so challenging and so worthwhile to just have to distill all of what they've been trying to learn at Webster into a few paragraphs.
Well, I don't think that was a challenge just for the students. I know I had a lot of difficulty distilling everything into something very, very short.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and it's been my observation that a great many Jewish people who were victims of the Holocaust came to St. Louis. It seems to me that there may be even a disproportionate number of those people here. Am I wrong in that, Jean? You're shaking your head.
Well, we think that there are probably about 300 people who relocated to St. Louis, mm-hmm. and as years have gone down, we're at fewer than about 100 people that have survived the Holocaust. And not everyone comes to the museum and wants to talk about their experience. It's very difficult. So we have a cadre of about 10 or 12 survivors who courageously do that for us on a regular basis. And I want to encourage people to come because that is probably one of the most powerful moments you'll have when you have the actual opportunity to hear some of the last eyewitnesses of this genocide and have the opportunity to have a dialogue with them and ask them questions about their experience.
And, of course, you typically have been recording these stories.
Absolutely.
Over the
We've
years.
Been doing it. We did it long before Mr. Spielberg. We actually started an oral history project in the late 1970s. We have a woman who has graciously volunteered for us for the last 25 years or so, a sister, Vida Prince, who has been instrumental, and she's been recording these oral histories for over 30 years.
Well, once again, as time gets away from us, a brand new exhibit is opening tomorrow at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. It's called The Change Begins With Me. It opens tomorrow morning at 9:45. Then it will be open Monday through Thursdays from 9:30 to 4:30 p.m., 9:30 to 4 p.m. on Fridays. We have a link to the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center website on our website at stlpublicradio.org. You can learn more there. I want to thank you all so much for being with us.
Well,
Gene Cavender, great
thank
to see you,
you
again.
Thank you.
Warren Rosenblum, great to see you. And Michael Holsizer, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being with us. A most informative hour. We appreciate you being here very much. And we continue tomorrow. On tomorrow's program, we'll talk about women's entrepreneurship in the St. Louis region, and then we'll take a look at the effort at St. Louis University to develop a new vaccine for tuberculosis. It's still with us, folks. My personal thanks to Jim Kircher for filling in for me for the last couple of days while I was on jury duty. Jim, thank you so much. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.